This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson with you on this rainy midweek day, and I've got Cary Jr. II sitting across from me, soaking wet from having walked into the studio. Hey, Cary.
Yeah, I mean, it just started pouring. I mean, I was almost inside the station.
Yeah, I mean, this has just become part of life here in Southeast Michigan.
Yeah.
In the summer, we're going to have storms like we don't remember having storms. When I was a kid here, and certainly as a young adult, we didn't have this kind of weather, at least not regularly. And now, you know, at least once a summer, we have a really violent storm, you know, with high winds and lots of water. And the thing that people have become really accustomed to dealing with is the flooding that happens when this goes on.
Yeah, the flooding happens because we get so much rainfall. And then we also talk about our infrastructure and what it can handle and what it can't handle. When I think about the rain and the flooding, I think it was 2021 when we had major flooding across the city of Detroit, and areas like Dearborn and areas like Jefferson Chalmers mm-hmm. had homes where their basements were completely flooded. And
Grosse Pointe.
Yeah. So all types of areas throughout Southeast Michigan were flooded like that. So now we have this advisory. Hopefully we don't experience the same amount of floods, but it does bring up this question of what is our infrastructure and kind of what is the history that kind of goes behind what's informing how our city handles all this water.
Yeah, I want to pause and make a point that I make a lot about infrastructure around here. We do a very, very poor job of maintaining the infrastructure that built up Detroit and the surrounding area, and the backlog maintenance with our storm sewers and the other things that manage water like this mm-hmm. Is in the billions of dollars. I mean, the increased water fees or taxes or however we chose to do that would blow people's minds if mm-hmm. we actually decided to try to catch up and manage this. Yeah, I mean, we haven't done it in decades. And so, that's a huge part of the problem. But today we want to actually talk about something a little different, which mm-hmm. is the history of this area mm-hmm. and some things that exist that most people don't know exist that are helping to make the flooding worse.
Yeah, we're going to talk about streams and wetlands that used to exist in a bunch of cities across the country, but were built on top of these streams and create what we call ghost streams, or what are called ghost streams. And so we're going to talk about how those, not necessarily ghost streams itself, but like how does that impact your susceptibility to being flooded? How does flooding and the infrastructure change depending on where you are? There's inland versus coastal, and so we have a great guest who knows quite a bit about this and can talk to us and explain how that all ties together.
And this connects with one of our themes here on Created Equal, which is just overall historical inequality. The areas mm-hmm. that are affected by these ghost streams mm-hmm. Are disproportionately inhabited by poor people and by people of color here in Metro Detroit. And so when you think of the neighborhoods that are getting hit the hardest by all of this, you think of these ghost streams, but then you also think of who lives mm-hmm. in those areas.
And I will say a lot of areas are impacted. There's coastal areas that may also not be people of color.
Sure.
But the ghost streams themselves can affect more inland neighborhoods, and so it's more about like the uneven distribution of the flooding, right? Everyone's getting, not everyone, but a lot of places are being flooded.
Yeah. So we're going to talk with Jacob Naprolsky, this professor of geology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. We also want to hear from you, the listeners. What are you doing this wet Wednesday here in Metro Detroit? What's the flooding look like in your neighborhood? What do you do to manage the flooding that we've become so used to during these summer storms? Jacob Naprolsky, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah. So I want to start with the idea of what causes some of the flooding that we have experienced. There are a number of different factors that contribute to an area's flood risk. Talk about what they are.
Yeah, that's correct. Flooding is a complex problem. There usually is not just a single factor that causes flooding. So flooding in rural areas might be slightly different than the causes behind flooding in urban environments. But as you guys were just mentioning, just being on a coast or near a large body of water, you have coastal flooding versus inland flooding. So in this area in southeastern Michigan, we deal with a lot of sprawl, which is using concrete and surfaces that when it rains out, the water cannot go into the soil. So it just moves very quickly horizontally. Mm-hmm. It has to be captured and conveyed and pushed out to some other place. And a lot of times those are places where we might store the water and treat it, or it might directly enter into a body of water. So like the Rouge River, for example. And so that Rouge River ends up flooding and overflowing its banks. But there are lots of people who will experience flooding, and it's not because they're next to a river. And this is typically what we refer to as pluvial flooding. Mm-hmm. And that's just because it's urban development. And that's what's causing a lot of the flooding. There's a lot of concretes. There's a lot of a very complex, relatively old environment where we've pieced together this water conveyance system. And we're trying to keep up with developments, keep up with the sprawl. But we also have to keep up with environmental change as well. So yeah. We're getting storms, as you guys mentioned, some storms that just didn't really happen so frequently several decades ago, they're now happening quite frequently.
So before we get to more of this kind of environmental contributor to the floods, I do want to talk about infrastructure just for a minute, because it's one of the things that I'm obsessed with, frankly, here in Southeast Michigan. I think we've done a spectacularly poor job maintaining that infrastructure. But I guess my question for you is whether these things that you focus on and kind of the natural environment and how we manage it, whether it could be mitigated fully by infrastructure. In other words, could we design and build and maintain an infrastructure that would negate the effects of these natural phenomena you're talking about that are affected by development? In other words, could we build our way out of these problems, in your opinion?
Ooh, that's a very good question, because I think it's human nature for us to think that we can outwits and outsmart Mother Nature.
Right.
And I don't think that that's always possible. And I think we would be playing with people's lives if we take that gamble and think that we can out-engineer and capture all the water and minimize flooding. The reality is flooding is actually a normal process. It's just something that's inconvenient to humans. And the way we see life, we like roads that are straight lines, we like intersections that are 90 degrees, but rivers don't follow that. They meander, they overflow their banks, and so our instinct is to get rid of them and replace it with infrastructure. But infrastructure can only manage and help so much. I think there is a certain point where we have to understand that natural interventions might also have to be introduced as well.
Yeah. So let's talk about the history of these ghost streams, and what that even is. I've been reading up on this subject for a while now, because we've been planning to talk about this for a while, but I have to admit I didn't know much about it before, and I hadn't really heard the term in common use before. So let's start with just a definition. What are ghost streams, and where in our area here in Southeast Michigan would we have seen these streams once upon a time?
So we can just basically define a ghost stream or wetland as a structure or a feature that existed in the past that functioned like a wetland, flowed like a river, but then after European settlers come, we begin to sprawl and develop, and we see this as an inconvenience, and so we drain and remove. So a river can be removed by simply dropping it underground so that it still actually is flowing, but it's no longer visible on the surface. Mm-hmm. Or in lots of situations, we literally just removed it from the landscape. So a lot of times there are rolling hills in your community that are not random hills. They are a stream valley that no longer fills with water. But that landscape does remember what it's supposed to do, even though we've tried to change it. And of course, that's where water will collect. So if we were to think a little bit about how we got to this point, it's probably helpful to remind the listeners that humans and rivers always had a very close partnership.
Mm-hmm.
So the birth of human civilization was along banks of a river. And when the Industrial Revolution hits, we began to not see rivers for the services and the resources that we used to see, but we saw them as a bit of a pain. And so we started to replace that with urban infrastructure. And so that meant we took rivers, these really nice, intricate systems of connected rivers and channels and streams and tributaries filled, teeming with life, aquatic life. And then we just started to pluck them and remove them from the landscape. And so fast forward to today, we're dealing with the end product of that. And it's not to say that a ghost stream or a ghost wetland causes flooding, but it should actually be seen as a contributing factor. So a good example, you guys mentioned this before, was Jefferson Chalmers.
Mm-hmm.
That's an abandoned, that's a ghost wetland. That was a coastal wetland that's been drained. And if you look at flood risk in that community, it is severe to extreme.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back 100-150 years here in Detroit and Southeast Michigan, and just, you know, draw an image, I guess, of how much more water there was here than there is now. This was a very wet area, and not just because of the Detroit River. There were lots of smaller inland and tributary kinds of waterways that came off the Detroit River, but give us a sense of what the landscape here would have been like that long ago.
When Michigan became a state, it was one of the first things we needed to do was draw up maps and then start to distribute land, which meant we sent cartographers and mappers out. And this was a very difficult job because they would always report how nearly impossible it was to go straight lines in Michigan due to all these wetlands, mm-hmm. fens, bogs, meandering rivers. So Michigan was seen as a very water-rich state at the time. Where we are in sort of the southeastern Michigan parts, it's the Detroit lowlands. There's low relief. We have mostly clay, so it's not the most absorbent soil. But we had a really intricate network of streams draining this area. As an example, we don't have to go back 150 years. Work that my colleagues and I did for the city of Detroit, we looked at 1905, the very first year the United States Geological Survey put out their topographic maps. We took all of the rivers that we found in the city of Detroit. We traced them and drew them, and then we compared that to the network that exists today. And over 86% of the rivers are missing from 1905 to today. And when you look at older maps from 1860, as an example, the city of Detroit already has rivers missing. So the practice of removing rivers from the urban landscape happened almost immediately. As soon as we began to see the core part of the city of Detroit as this valuable hub that we were developing and radiating out from, we just started removing rivers left and right. And so that left us with remnants of rivers, but also a desperate need to manage stormwater because the rivers were no longer there to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Professor of Geology, Jacob Naporalski, about ghost streams and wetland and water management here in Southeast Michigan. We want to get going with you, the listeners, as well, on the phones. Give us a call. Let us know what you are doing this wet day here in Southeast Michigan. How is the rain and the potential flooding affecting you? Do you live in an area that floods almost all the time right now? Did it not used to flood? Talk about when that changed and how your life has changed in terms of preparing for these big storms that we have each summer and the consequences that come from them. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're talking about the rain and the commensurate flooding here in Southeast Michigan here on Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I've got a great guest with us today. Jacob Naparowski is a professor of geology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. His expertise focuses on understanding the impact of past and future environmental change on people. We're talking specifically about ghost streams, former waterways that existed here in Southeast Michigan and Detroit and the surrounding area that are contributors to the problems that we have right now with stormwater management. It's raining more. It's raining faster these days than it did in the past. And that means the landscape that we live among needs to be better at managing the water so that it doesn't collect in people's basements, people's backyards, doesn't flood the streets that we need to walk and drive down here in Southeast Michigan. That's happening far more frequently right now than it has in the past. We want to hear from you as well during this conversation. I know lots of people who listen to the show live in areas that are flooding more frequently and more dramatically than they have in the past. We'd love to hear how you prepare for storms like the one that we're having right now here in Detroit. What do you do to make sure that the flooding doesn't wipe you out, damage your home, damage your belongings, inconvenience you in the way that it can? 2021 was a real lesson in living here in Detroit and Metro Detroit. The terrible storms we had that summer caused all kinds of damage. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Created Equal or at WDET, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Jacob, before we get to our listeners, I want to connect the history that we were talking about in the previous segment, the waterways that used to be here, what we did with them, and what that sort of causes in terms of flooding instability, with the issue of inequality, and talk about the places that are most at risk today because of the eradication of these waterways in the past. So you made a comparison of old maps to new maps, found a pattern that that suggests that that people of color and people with lower incomes are more likely to live in these flooding areas than other people.
That's correct. We looked at history, and we wanted to look at the history of the landscape, but also history of the people. And in one particular aspect to our research, we were interested in what we did in the 30s and 40s, which was called redlining, where bankers and lenders were very curious to know what the risk was for investing in communities all over the United States. I think there's over 200 some cities that had this done in their own city. So in Detroit, we have a really large, again, Metro Detroit's large, so we have large areas that underwent this determination of economic risk. And if you were scored an A, that meant you were in a community that was definitely worth investing. Banks should certainly give you great deals. It was worth investing in, living in. If you were in a D neighborhood, you were considered in some of the more difficult neighborhoods. A lot of times that was low income, mm-hmm. minorities, immigrants, non-English speaking, and so on. So that practice was eventually outlawed, but we were very interested in whether the remnants of that still have some contribution to flood inequity. So why some communities get hit harder with floods than others. And so just to give you some backgrounds, you know, we looked at social and environmental indicators. So if we just looked at A versus D, so the best versus those that were considered the highest risk, mm-hmm. A communities right now, if you live in an A community, there's about 10% poverty and there's about 8% vacancy. if you compare that against all of the D communities that we have in Detroit, that is about one third. So it's about 36% poverty rate, 24% vacancy, and the median home income is less than 25%. So it still remains an issue. So we think that there must be a connection. If that's the case, there must be an environmental connection. And sure enough, if you look at tree canopy cover, if you live in an A neighborhood, it's really green. It's lush, over 25% tree canopy cover compared to 8% in D neighborhoods. So we went at this and asked the question, well, if that's the case, then we probably have more concrete. We have far more summer heat. And so we have communities that are probably going to get hit much harder with these floods than really comfortable, green, lush neighborhoods. And it turns out that tends to be true.
I want to talk about places that people would be familiar with on the map and understand the sort of day-to-day illustration of what you were just talking about. Can you think of places? I mean, we were talking about Jefferson Chalmers earlier. I think lots of people have heard of that area now because of the flooding that they've experienced. But it's not just in places like that.
No. So our map was sort of controlled by where we had these red lines and blue lined and green lines communities. Mm-hmm. So it's a patchwork of polygons on a map. There are a lot of really good ones that are lower down in the watershed. So we talk about coastal. So the state of Michigan has a coastal management zone. And so Jefferson Chalmers is a part of that. But any coastal areas, Grosse Pointe, they're all part of that. And so there's additional flood risk. But when you're down in the lower parts, those have areas where rivers have been buried. So some great examples are off of the Rouge. There's some communities in the Del Rey community and Ecorse. And those are areas where you no longer see rivers and streams. And you can actually kind of follow and walk this meandering depression in the landscape that's now a series of very organized, well-situated houses and infrastructure. So no longer meanders, no longer shows any examples of being a river, but the landscape has that very gentle stream valley. So when it rains out, those roads, those communities flood, but they're not necessarily because it's near a river.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag created equal, or at WDET. Let's start with Kwame, who is in Jefferson Chalmers. Kwame, welcome to the show.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Stephen, for having me. And thanks for putting together this topic.
Sure.
This is an important topic that we all in Jefferson Chalmers experienced firsthand. I believe this the ghost streams and the ghost rivers is really interesting. ECN, Eastside Community Network, they put together a bike ride tour from time to time, and one of these tours was on Connors, and they talked about the river that used to run the Connor Creek, and the importance of it and how it was covered, and now it's an underground, it's part of the combined sewage system. And then also Fox Creek used to connect to the Milk River and used to be flowing, and now Fox Creek is kind of stagnant, and it contributes to a lot of the issues that we face in Jefferson Chalmers. Just thank you for putting together this topic. Being a resident of Jefferson Chalmers, I lived there in 2001, and my basement had 36 inches of water in my basement.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was a new resident, and I thought I saw the worst, and I happen to work with a nonprofit organization named Freshwater Future, and I've been able to partner with some of the nonprofits and grassroots organizations in Jefferson Chalmers, and part of that partnership involved collecting data from the residents who experienced firsthand what they, what happened in 2021 and even previously.
Yeah.
And even afterwards. And so you're talking about water flooding basements up to the ceiling almost. And it's just disheartening. And families are still dealing with that with mildew issues.
Yeah.
But I was definitely want to go ahead.
So Kwame, I'm curious if you can talk about the kinds of things that you find yourself now doing to prepare for days like today, and I guess to we'll experience some of this tomorrow as well. How does this change the way you think about storms and the weather? What kind of things can you do to protect your house?
Getting to the protection part, first gotta get past the trauma, because the trauma is still there. Whenever it rains, a lot of times it's the coach. He's like, I hope it doesn't flood in my basement, or how bad would it flood?
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, it's like, well, I need to make sure my valuables, the most valuable things, aren't in the basement. So in my case, I live in a part of Jefferson Chalmers that floods very easily. And so, no, I don't put my appliances in the basement. I keep very few things down there. All my valuables are usually in the attic. And have to try to make other adjustments.
Yeah. Yeah. Kwame, I really appreciate the call and the detailed narrative there about living in Jefferson Chalmers. Jacob Naparowski, I'll give you a chance to respond to some of the things that Kwame was talking about in terms of what they're doing. My big question for a neighborhood, a community like Jefferson Chalmers is kind of back to my very first question, which is there a way that is there an amount of money that we could spend that would protect that community from this vulnerability that is getting worse as the weather changes? You know, is this something we could control given the things that we've done to erase the natural landscape and the way that it managed, you know, floodwaters?
I think that community is in a unique position in that it's so close to the Detroit River, but it's also sort of on the low end of the city of Detroit. So when you have water running off the city of Detroit, it heads towards the coast. So you may end up experiencing floodwaters coming from different places, yes, not just a single direction.
It all collects there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of like you have a beautiful view, you're close to a body of water, but there are some downsides to that because water is dynamic. And I think if we want to try to capture, control, engineer it, we typically aim for specific design events. So we want to say, okay, we're going to build infrastructure that ensures that the 50-year rain event does not cause a flood.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that that's now a moving target. What used, as you guys mentioned before, what used to be a 50-year is probably a 10-year now.
Hmm.
And so what we engineered in the past needs to be updated to reflect that change. And so it's very difficult with certainty to say we can spend a lot of money and protect that community. There are smaller interventions that could be done, but I think hearing him talk about, of concern to me is that flooding fatigue, that stress and trauma, because that pushes residents to a tipping point where they eventually pack up and leave. And then you end up with what we call climate abandoned areas.
Right.
And we're starting to see that more in the U.S. In the last two decades, over 3 million people have packed up and left because it just is too wet or too hot.
Mm.
And so Jefferson Chalmers is one of those vulnerable communities where if something isn't done, I would have loved to have asked Kwame, what is your tipping point? What if you get 4 floods in a year? Are you just going deal with it? Or will you try to find a way out? Because I think the city of Detroit wants to know this. They want to bring people back. But on the other hand, people don't want to just knowingly enter a flood zone.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that Kwame's call reminds me of is an idea I've heard of, and I don't know how feasible it is. What if we were to try to bring back some of the waterways that development got rid of? What if we wanted to return parts of the metro area to waterways, to streams, to sort of river inlets that would manage this the way that the land did before all of this development? How feasible is that? I mean, could we even imagine doing something like that?
We can always imagine. Whether it's feasible or not is the next question, because we have such a complex system that has just sprawled out. And so what we refer to as stream daylighting, so we kind of take the roof off the river and bring it back. But in doing so, we need to understand where that river is connected.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that water is flowing underground for great distances. It's captured off of impervious surfaces. It's not the, the cleanest of water. And then all of a sudden the ceiling is off and it's a river. It, the quality might not be as good. So there's a lot of things. It's not just simply bringing the river back. It's fitting that river into that system, not overwhelming it, but also understanding how do we have to manage it, since it's a, sort of a piece to this really complex puzzle. How do we manage it so that it doesn't fall apart and become sort of a wasteland or become stagnant water where now you have dumping ground or mosquitoes? Mm-hmm. It's got to flow like a normal river. And so how it relates to the rest of the system, it's a complex problem. There are some really good examples in New York. Kalamazoo has a great example of a successful stream daylighting, but a slightly different environment than in a large sprawled city like Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Professor Jacob Naparalski, Professor of Geology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Also continue to hear from you on the phones and on social. Give us a call. Let us know how you're preparing for the potential flooding from storms here in Metro Detroit. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag created equal, or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and we've got Jacob Naparalski with us. He's a professor of geology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. His expertise is in understanding the impact of past and future environmental change on people. We're talking a little bit about environmental change, long-term environmental change, and short-term environmental change that is causing a lot of the flooding that we all worry about so much here in Southeast Michigan every time we get these big summer storms, which are becoming more frequent and more intense. We want to hear from you about how you prepare for these storms. What kinds of things go through your mind when you see on the weather report that we're gonna have a storm like the one that we're having right now? What kind of things do you prepare for? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. Let's go to Lonnie in Detroit. Lonnie, what's on your mind?
How you doing?
Good.
I live in Northwest Detroit over there by the old U of D Justice High School.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the landscapers, after they cut the grass and all the debris, they blow it back into the street. And I thought that was against the law, that they don't pick it up. They just blow it into the street and leave it in the street. So when it rains, all that goes down the drain.
All of it goes into the storm sewers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Lonnie, it's a great point. I see it in my neighborhood, of course. I think you can go to lots of places around the city and witness that. Jacob, what should we be doing with the way we treat the storm sewers and what we put down them? I mean, we know that the infrastructure of our storm sewers is in bad shape. We also know that we have a unified system that makes it a little harder. In other words, that the sewers themselves and the storm sewers all kind of connect, and that makes for a real mess sometimes. But what should we be thinking about when we talk about lawn refuse or other things that end up in the street and then end up in the storm sewers?
I guess I would say put as little as possible, and that's debris and water. So I think if we plug those drains up with leaves, branches, that's a problem. Water cannot get into the system, so it ends up in your streets and starts to creep into your property, your basements, your garage. I do have issues with that on a number of levels, because this is organic material that we're treating like garbage, and then we end up blowing it and it ends up on roads and it becomes a complex problem. And it ends up being, even though you are hiring someone to cut your lawn and clean it, you're now going to be very likely taxed higher at some point because they have to fix the system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a collective problem where I think communities need to understand how best to avoid water going into that system and any debris, because it just becomes a costly endeavor and then eventually overwhelms it. So a lot of the work that we've done with communities, you know, the city of Detroit had a push for people to disconnect their downspouts from going directly from the roof into the system, instead trying to divert that onto their lawns to allow the soil to absorb that material. And that keeps water out of the system. So if we can just sort of minimize the amount, of, it's inevitable, water will go into the system, but if we can minimize it, that's the best option.
Yeah, yeah. Lonnie, really appreciate the call and that example. Let's go next to Robert in Detroit. Robert, what's on your mind?
Hi. This is probably one of my favorite topics. There's just so many things that could be done, and I think it needs to be a combination of restoring things more back to nature, but also doing more in infrastructure to try to manage this water. One example of a success story, I think, is Heinz Drive. That was designed to accommodate floods.
Hmm.
And why does it stop at Dearborn? Why doesn't it go all the way to the Detroit River?
Hmm.
Money is the issue. We talk about canopy. Detroit is full of tree canopy, but most people can't afford to take care of the trees on their private property or on the easements. So money is needed there. We're giving so much money in tax breaks for stadiums and stuff like that. When that money for taxes should be going towards this kind of infrastructure.
Sure.
One other
be.
Thing that I see is the Netherlands and all their beautiful canals. One of my favorite restaurants in Detroit is Coriander Kitchen. You sit there by the canal, you see people kayaking by, riding their bikes, and it's like, why not more canals in the city? I know an architect in the 1980s that designed a whole neighborhood in southwest Detroit by introducing canals and taking some of the industrial sites and putting housing on them and having bridges. It was called Bridgetown. But that person had left to the West Coast. There are a lot of people in Detroit with a lot of great ideas, but they don't stick around because these ideas are not being implemented.
Yeah, Robert, wonderful points to make in this conversation about how we manage all these things, especially the part about how much money all of these things might cost to do or to take care of better, and the fact that in so many cases we kind of give up a lot of money in tax breaks. Jacob Naporalski, I'll give you a chance to respond to Robert.
I think Robert's points are spot on. It's something needs to be done. There's lots of creative solutions, but it seems like we're always stuck. And hearing residents call in and talk about their concerns about flooding and how important it is does stress why so many neighborhood organizations and nonprofits are trying to tackle this. And they tackle it best by connecting pieces. So it's not just one neighbor. It's a neighborhood that's working with another neighborhood, which is reaching out to the municipality and the water authority. And I think the voice of residents needs to be louder and stronger. You know, if you have a municipality that has a call-in or an app where you can say, my house is flooded, you know, that's very valuable data to people like me. I love data. That's my thing. So when I get that data, you know, I could be a bit more informed with how I see flooding. So having residents be active participants in the ideas, I think, is really important. We can't shut them out. And again, the nature-based solutions is spot on. There's no reason why we can't mix. You know, we talk about engineering and capturing everything. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not necessarily our goal. Our goal is to accept that nature is going to do what it wants to do. Once in a while, we accept it. And so in some places, we have nature-based solutions. But I think the residents, their voice, it is getting louder. And I so appreciate people coming with great ideas and observations. And again, some people have been in Detroit for 80 years, and they remember rivers that are no longer there.
That are
so
gone.
They're the ones that can stand up and say, yeah, I remember swimming in this river. This is the first place I learned to ice skate. And now you go there and it's a subdivision.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert, really appreciate the call and the really great points. Let's go next to John, who's also on the east side in Jefferson Chalmers. Hey, John.
Good morning. Great conversation. I missed about 10 minutes of it, but I just want to talk about what I found recently. So I live on Scripps, which is the very south street from Jefferson before the Detroit River. Mm-hmm. And it only goes from Ashland to Lakewood. And it is actually 60 feet under Scripps is actually the natural canal. Then behind my house is the canal they dug out.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to point out is when you go through Grosse Pointe Park, anytime you turn south on any of those streets, you notice this great big rise in the elevation, almost like a hump at points. And that is the Fox Creek or the Milk River. The Fox Creek eventually attaches to the Milk River. And you can visibly see it all underneath there.
Hmm.
Now, back in 1906, they got tired of the bridges for the Fox Creek and the Connor Creek washing out, and that's how Grosse Pointers got downtown. And so they decided, well, we're just going to fill this in. Still right under there. So at Marshall's Bar, you look at the canal, you walk out of Marshall's Bar, and you turn to the right, there's the Fox Creek. It goes right underneath Jefferson. And it continues all the way to Macomb County.
So, John, are you saying that you feel like maybe we made a mistake burying the Fox and Connor Creek waterways?
The infrastructure is down in this neighborhood, and all that used to flood in the springs and such, is once the pipes are filled, the pipes are filled, and the basement is next.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. John, I really appreciate the call and that detail about what's going on in Jefferson, Chalmers, and in Grosse Pointe Park, which is, of course, right next door to it. Jacob, I want to talk about, that's a really specific example, these two waterways that were covered over because they were flooding areas that people wanted to live, right? They were interfering with life, human life. We cover them, and now, in part because we covered them, we're dealing with flooding too. In other words, the solution may have been the problem in this instance. And I guess that takes us back to this question of whether the better approach might be to kind of systematically try to undo some of the things that we did that are coming back, I guess, to haunt us here in the future.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's also important for us to hesitate before signing off on the next big engineering project.
Right. So, we love big engineering projects.
Right. I mean, it's great to be a human. We can build things, but it does seem like we move very quickly in these decision-making processes. And we have communities where there's a river, it floods, which is a natural process, but then residents complain, so they bury it, they build more homes on it, and then decades later, we find out that the landscape has a memory. It mm-hmm. still remembers that mm-hmm. a river is supposed to be there, and so water then fills up, and again, when the pipes are full, the pipes are full. There's mm-hmm. no place for the water to go, so it ends up in people's basements because that's the sort of the localized depression in the landscape, and so it ends up in residents' homes instead of in natural places.
Yeah. Yeah. John, I, again, really appreciate the call and that great info. Let's go to Mary in Huntington Woods. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Huntington Woods, and this is an old wetland. So we've had water problems until we put sump pump in.
Hmm.
So what's the difference as far as, and in Detroit? I mean, I lived in Detroit half my life, and there was... east side of Detroit. It mm-hmm. wasn't down by Jefferson and Chalmers, but still the east side. And we would get water in our basement. So mm-hmm. what's the difference between draining these riverbeds and wetlands?
Mm. It's a good question, Mary. And as we were talking earlier, we've got lots of things in southeast Michigan that help contribute to this. The coastal areas are one kind of issue. And then wetlands that were more inland are a different issue. Jacob, can you help clarify that difference for Mary?
Yes. What am I clarifying?
She wants to know what the difference is between like a wetland, a former wetland like Huntington Woods, and a coastal area like Jefferson Chalmers.
Oh, okay. Yes. So, you know, before
and
we started,
I have to say, I didn't know that Huntington Woods was a former wetland. I mean, I think that's kind of indicative of how we live here. We don't pay a lot of attention to these things in the history. I've not heard that before.
Right. And you would be surprised how many residents know these little nuggets of knowledge about their community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. You know, when someone calls in and says this used to be a wetland, well, that's interesting because mm-hmm. that means that they have some sense of the movement of water and how it's changed because of the way humans developed it. So in areas, if you can imagine just driving a little bit to the northwest, you end up getting into the Walled Lake area. Mm-hmm. And these are all water-rich areas.
Yes.
There are a mixture of wetlands. You go out to Dexter on the other side of Ann Arbor, really water-rich inland wetlands. A lot of those were drained for agricultural purposes. So it gives us really nutritious soils. But because, you know, a lot of these neighborhoods were on the outskirts of the urban core as the city of Detroit spreads, we would drain them and actually put homes. So in essence, the process that usually means that there's a slight depression in the landscape. So wetlands occupy low places just like they do on the coast, mm-hmm. you know, the lowest parts before you hit the sea or hit a lake. And so you have these inland areas that are the local depressions in the landscape. And so even if you drain them, unless you build them up and they're topographic high, water's still going to collect there. Meanwhile, you have people that live on the Detroit River, and that's, again, another topographic low. But you have the fluctuation of water from the Detroit River that rises, ebbs, and falls as the Great Lakes system goes through its seasons and goes through, you know, sort of lake highs and lake lows. And so during highs, you can have water that surges inland. And if it's during a rain event, you can also be getting rainfall from running off of concrete structures in communities that are adjacent to you. So there are these differences between being on the coast, being subjected to some of these hazards and risks because you're near a large body of water, but also in an urban environment. And that's different than being slightly away from that coastal zone, but you're still on a buried wetland that no longer functions as a wetland.
Yeah, yeah. And Mary's idea of putting a sump pump in her basement, that certainly would help at her individual property. But mm-hmm. is that the kind of solution that doesn't really solve the problem because it's just moving the water out of the basement? It's not abating the problem that's causing the water. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's just taking the water and trying to save your property. And that is priority number one for every resident. It's their valuables. It's their sentimental goods that are not replaceable that they are trying to save. And so if that means taking water out of their system, they're going to send it out. And sometimes that's down the driveway, that's back to the streets, which goes to the stormwater system. And now it's more of a collective problem. But you can't blame a resident for doing that. That mm-hmm. is exactly what you want to do in order to mitigate the problem on your own property.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Jacob Naparowski, it was really great to have you here with us to talk about the rain outside and the floods that we worry are coming. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
I can't remember the name of that caller. I believe it was Robert who was on the east side. Was it Robert who had observed the wetlands on the ground? He said, you turn off Jefferson, you can see.
That was John.
John. Yeah. Okay, John from the east side. That's right. John is a regular caller.
Yeah.
Now he's going to have me going around the city of Detroit kind of looking at the
surface.
To see where there potentially could be some of the wetlands in the neighborhoods around here.
I would encourage anyone who's really curious about this and wants to know more about where we live, just drive the east side of Detroit. Go down anywhere east of about Connor, really. Mm-hmm. You can drive through the neighborhoods now and really see
yeah.
the effect of you know, our neglect of infrastructure, but also of the brutalization of the land that we've done that creates all of this flooding. I mean, it's something else. I mean, it is nothing like what I can remember from this community.
There's also those nice, I don't know what they call those, the creeks, like one of the callers was talking about, the restaurant that's on the mm-hmm, water. Mm-hmm. It's also nice, too. It's not all all bad infrastructure.
Water's a wonderful thing. I mean, there are studies that say that people who live on water are more zen and more calm and have a higher quality of life. So it's not that. It's that we aren't managing it in a way that makes any sense.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
Yeah. Okay, that is going to do it for us on Created Equal. Remember, you can listen to recent episodes of the show at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The engineer is Nate Bender. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.